Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the Frequent Issuers Managing Editor.
And I'm John Hay, the Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
Coming up this week, exciting times in European securitization with our reporter George Smith, and in particular the pricing dynamic in the RMBS and covered bond markets. And that's something you got very excited about in the editorial meeting this week, isn't it, John?
Yes, because what happened this week is we had a very major securitization of mortgages in the UK by Lloyds Bank, which priced inside its cover, or where people thought a covered bond would have priced of a similar sort of size and maturity. And that is a sort of reversal of fortune that hasn't happened for a very long time.
But first, we'll take a look at the public sector bond market and a story by our Sovereign Supranationals and Agencies editor, Addison Gong, which talks about dollar funding for SSAs. That's a very big popular market and a main source of funding for these issuers. But it's not been access all areas for all borrowers of late. And of course, at the moment, we've had a US regional banking crisis and now the US debt ceiling debate. And yet there's been a spate of deals.
Yeah, we're really talking about the non-dollar-based, or at least non-US-based SSA issuers, particularly those from Europe and Japan. And this week there was a spate of deals by French agency CADES, the Council of Europe Development Bank, Comuna Credit, and NRW Bank from Germany, which raised $6 billion between them. These are the sorts of issuers that are very price sensitive. They all have access to the dollar market, but they only go there when it's efficient for them to do so. And for a while, it hasn't been very attractive.
Yeah, what they do is they borrow in dollars and then they enter into a swap to take that funding back into euros. And about a month ago, they were sort of, it was basically there was a 5 to 10 basis point differential for them to do that swap. And that's an awful lot of cash in SSA market terms, which is very refined and tends to move in single or fractions of basis points. But this week, one of those issuers told us that actually moving that funding back into its home currency was pretty much flat. So that's a really big, really big difference. Mm. I think this has been something that's this sort of, I suppose, I don't want to say lack of access, but lack of cost-effective access has been a feature of the dollar market and SSAs ever since the Fed started putting up rates earlier than everywhere else. And, you know, we noticed last year that big SSA issuers like EIB and KfW had done less of their funding in dollars and were having to rely much more on euros to raise what they needed. And these guys issue, you know, tens and tens of billions a year. I think EIB and KfW issue something like 80, 85 billion euros worth of debt a year. So these really are big numbers.
And do you think some of them, you know, there'll be more dollar issuance by this sort of borrower then?
Yeah, I think they will absolutely take it where they can get it. But of course, that's the big problem, isn't it? I think they always look to do dollar deals. Indeed, we've got Addison spoke to three issuers in the article that are all planning to do dollar deals, KfW being one of them, in fact. But of course, it will depend on the dynamics and in the sort of cross-currency swap market. And how the rest of the banking crisis plays out, and possibly also the debate around the debt ceiling.
Yeah, I mean, that's something obviously we've seen before. I think, Addison, there's some staggering number, like 80 times that the debt ceiling, 78, there it is, which has had to be revised in the last 60 years. But there does seem to be a sort of particular sort of nastiness about this time, don't you think? Or is it just that we haven't had it for a couple of years and people have forgotten?
I think it's that. It's also one of those stories that I think is it's sort of deceptive in the sense that it sounds big and serious, and of course it is big and serious, but at the same time, eventually a deal gets done, the debt ceiling is raised, or there are other measures put in place, and, you know, it never really leads to the financial catastrophe that we're sort of said is, that we're told is possible while the debate is going on. And I think that's very much reflected in the in what people in the SSA market were saying this week about whether it matters or not. And I think on the one hand, you know, there was evidence that all these deals are sort of flying off the shelves. So or as much as, you know, SSA issuers are sort of able to get these deals done, they're not necessarily all having a wonderful time. I don't think the Council of Europe was able to tighten pricing on its deal. It had to price where it started marketing, for example. But thereafter, you know, it's people are very split on whether the debt ceiling matters or not. Some people just don't think so at all. Other people think it does. And other people think it's like a convenient excuse to hide behind if you did a bit of a pup of a deal.
The weird thing about it, though, isn't it, is that you kind of can't price it in because it's such a kind of dramatic event. It's a bit like a kind of meteor strike or something.
Yeah.
There's almost no point trying to move your positions in financial markets to sort of get ready for it or prepare for it, because nobody really knows what the probabilities are. It's unknowable, right? It comes down to human beings in Congress negotiating, but you know, if the event doesn't happen, you've wasted your time and put on a wrong position. And if it does, you know, if it does, well, you might be a bit better off, but it's going to be complete carnage. So
yeah,
you might as well just like cross your fingers and sit tight.
Yeah, well, that's sort of a sentiment that we've heard expressed a lot over, I guess, the last 3 years, isn't it? So people have generally said of when that we've been facing a crisis of such magnitude that, well, what's the point? Well, not what's the point of worrying about it, but what's the point in trying to sort of finesse your positions? Because if it does go wrong in the manner suggested, then we've all got far bigger problems than whether or not we lose a couple of basis points holding SSA paper. I mean, Jim Leavis, the chief investment officer at chief investment officer for public fixed income, M&G Investments. He told us that there was not really any expectation that people will lose money from a US default, which is the sort of big consequence of a failure to raise the debt ceiling, because, you know, it always seems to get resolved. So
he's very much in the optimistic camp, I think, and there are others who aren't. And you know, I do think, you know, somebody else referred to it being like the boy who cried wolf.
Yes,
and we all know what happened to him in the end, right? Eventually he was right. And of course, you know, some of the Congress people are somewhat more towards the extreme end of the spectrum now than they ever were before. So what they're capable of is not known yet.
Yeah, well, we shall see in the coming weeks. I think another interesting asset class this week, John, was the emerging markets, wasn't it? There was a lot going on there. Again, another big political story in the sort of consequences of the first round of the Turkish election. But also it was interesting because I think what we saw this week was that some parts of emerging market issuance went absolutely gangbusters. I'm thinking particularly of the Sukuk market, but other parts of that universe can't get a deal done for love nor money, can they?
Yeah. That, I mean, you're right. It's an extreme contrast, and that isn't always the case in emerging markets, where often it does sort of tend to move together. In fact, this kind of divergence is something we've been seeing, you know, kind of building up since the pandemic, I think, isn't it? With, you know, countries that are particularly since the recovery from the pandemic, the countries that are energy providers and exporters are doing extremely well from the recovery and high energy prices, and the consumers of energy and, you know, other countries without, you know, particularly strong economies really suffering. But what's happening in Sukuk, Ralph? What were the signs there that things are bullish?
Oh, well, there were deals that achieved huge order books, where issuers were sort of pricing inside of secondary curves and all the usual good signs. Now, I think just to take a step back, what is the Sukuk market? These are deals that are structured to be bought by Islamic investors. So it's a bit like with the green bond market. You have a sort of slightly captive audience, I suppose, of people that have to buy whatever's put their way. So if not an awful lot comes their way, then they will stampede towards every trade that's sort of coming. This week, Saudi Arabia did a deal. It issued a $6 billion Sukuk, but that attracted $27 billion of orders. There was Noga Holding, which is the state-owned investment arm of Bahrain. It came 25 basis points inside its own estimations of sort of fair value with the $750 million deal. And there were others besides. It's, you know, and this is the, I guess, the very sort of highly rated end of the emerging market universe. So not only is this a sort of undersupplied market anyway, but it's very much, you know, in general, the issue is very much in favor. Someone in George Collard's story, who covered it this week, sort of pointed out that a lot of the Middle East borrowers are basically, they're all investment grade, apart from a few that are not. And most of those are quasi-sovereign credits anyway.
So is there any encouragement to be had from this busy Sukuk activity for other emerging market borrowers?
Well, yeah, quite possibly. There was issuance in the sort of conventional bond market too. There were deals from OTP Bank in Hungary that sold a $500 million 4-year non-call 3-year senior preferred deal. And the Polish State Development Bank, BGK, managed to get away a $1.75 billion 10-year bond. That's a issuer with a full state guarantee. I think though, those deals are great, but I think if you look at what works and what doesn't work at the moment, it's clearly investment grade type issuers. I think, you know, on the sort of junk rated or high yield issuer side, then it's not such a sort of, you know, a compelling case to come to market. And I think that's probably the case in Latin America, isn't it, John?
Well, I think the picture in Latin America is much worse, in fact, because the whole corporate sector is in really bad trouble. And, you know, it's not just difficulties in accessing the bond market or having to pay, you know, 100 to 400 basis points more. It's actual defaults. And, you know, the names defaulting include some, you know, really big, you know, companies that are well known even outside the region. So there really is a wave of proper corporate distress in Latin America. And it's partly because of the you know, interest rate rises in the US. I mean, that generally is the sort of trigger for economic pain in Latin America. And it seems to be proving so again.
So, John, is it just interest rates that are the problem, or there are other issues as well?
No, I think it's much broader and more deep-seated than that. For example, this week, Light, which is a Brazilian utility, went into bankruptcy. And the main problem there is that they look like they might not have their contract renewed to keep supplying electricity to Rio de Janeiro. So it's a purely operational thing. And this is a company that was rated BA3 BB- by Moody's and Fitch as recently as February. So it's really, that's pretty strong credit in emerging market terms. And, you know, it's failed to have good negotiations with its domestic bondholders and now, you know, it's gone into bankruptcy. So, you know, this is just one potential loss for international investors too. Another one, Inter Cement, a Brazilian company, has hired Houlihan Lokey, the restructuring firm, last week to help restructure its debt. It's got $1.7 billion of debt, including an international bond. And you know, there are more like Americanas, a big retailer, Oi, a telecom company in Brazil, the airline Gol, again in Brazil, a power company in Chile. So, you know, it's all over the place. And I think it's generalized economic distress that's been building since COVID and has been worsened by the sort of inflation surge of the last couple of years.
And one of the big problems for LATAM issuers, I suppose, is that because of the sort of geographic location and therefore where a lot of their investors are based in the US, they get compared a lot, don't they, to the US corporate bond market. And, you know, if you're a cautious debt investor, you actually get quite well paid in the US corporate market, rather than having to sort of risk exposure to LATAM credit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's even affecting the sort of specialist distressed debt investors that normally could be relied on at a time like this to buy, you know, the bonds of companies in trouble. One of the things that's been happening is that, you know, when the market's incredibly jittery. So when, you know, if a company announces disappointing results, their bonds are falling 10 or 20 percentage points on the day. In one day, which is very extreme. And these are exactly the sorts of situations where normally distressed debt funds would leap in, seeing an opportunity, would buy it. And that provides some support to the price. But they're not doing it because there's plenty of bargains for them in the US or other developed markets.
Yeah, it's a worrying time for LATAM credit, that's for sure. I guess another market also in a sort of a flux of uncertainty is Turkey, which we talked about last week. The election there was the first round, I think, against a lot of people's expectations in the market. The incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan did much better than expected, and the election's gone to a second round, which will take place on May the 28th. And last week we spoke about this rally that had taken place in Turkish assets and in sort of anticipation of an opposition win. It hasn't happened, and you've got to wonder if a lot of those people got burnt this week.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they have. I mean, we don't know. I mean, I think a lot of international investors would probably, the ones that are very down on Turkey and cautious about it because of its unorthodox economic policies, probably wouldn't have piled in last week just on the basis of an opinion poll. You know, so we don't know how many investors actually bought into Turkish bonds, but certainly they've been burnt if they did, because the 2030 and 2033 bonds it has outstanding, for example, which were trading at 8.4% and 8.6% just on Friday, just before the election, which is 100 basis points better than they'd been a week before, have widened to 10.5%. You know, straight after the weekend. So that, you know, that's a huge move. And you know, people are saying the market is now completely pricing out the chance of the opposition winning. So it's basically game over.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. And I guess, you know, we also need to see what happens for Turkish issuers, not least the sovereign, which still has $2.5 billion of funding to do this year. Now, it's a particularly nimble and well-respected debt management office, and one of the things it's done or has done in the last year or two is visit the Sukuk market, where it's been able to price quite attractively compared to what it could get in the conventional debt market. So perhaps once the dust settles on the election, we'll see them reappear there. I don't know.
I'm sure they'll consider it. And if they've got $2.5 billion left to do, that's very much within range of the Sukuk market, you'd think. But the, you know, on the sort of private sector side, there's been almost silence for a long time from Turkish issuers, banks and corporates. And, you know, that they've refinanced well in advance, so they don't need to come back too urgently. But, you know, they do have debt maturing next year, so they will have to find ways to refinance that. One encouraging sign this week that George Collard reported was Vakıf Bank, that one of the major banks, it managed to do a loan refinancing, and it's paying 425 or 400, depending on the currency, over base rates, which is a lot higher than the Turkish banks used to pay. But nevertheless, it's sort of affordable. And, you know, they borrowed $825 million. So that's an encouraging sign for Turkey.
Yeah. And also for Turkey's big corporates with big international businesses, they generally have these sort of big international operations. A lot of the revenue comes from overseas and they're not quite so exposed to these sort of domestic perils. So I guess they will take some encouragement from that.
So now we're very happy to invite for the first time George Smith, our securitization reporter, to the podcast, who's going to be talking about the securitization by Lloyds Bank of its mortgages, which we talked about at the beginning, which is called Permanent, and the exciting pricing dynamics around that.
morning, George. Welcome for the first time to the Global Capital Podcast.
Hi, Ralph. It's great to be on.
Good. Excellent. So, big news in the UK residential mortgage-backed security market this week when two big UK issuers brought deals. Right. First of all, just can you briefly explain what an RMBS is for the benefit of our non-securitization expert listeners, of which there are probably several?
So an RMBS is a securitization backed by mortgages, in this case residential mortgages. So it has all of the kind of normal structures of securitization. It has the subordination, credit enhancement. It's just that the collateral pool is mortgages, and it's probably the biggest asset class in securitization and considered one of the most important, probably the most important. There's several different types, including prime RMBS, which is owner occupied. These will have very kind of like reliable mortgages, good track records from like prime lenders, bank lenders. And then you have buy-to-let and non-conforming RMBS, and these don't qualify for the EU's securitization hallmark of simple, transparent, and standardized, which means the prime RMBS has better capital treatment than buy-to-let and non-conforming RMBS.
Okay, and this is a market we're looking at particularly at the moment, I guess, because there have been more deals than usual, and that's part of the what's going on generally with the way banks fund themselves, isn't it? That there's less central bank funding for them to rely on at such cheap levels, so they're having to go back out into the market to fund themselves in the capital markets, either through the senior unsecured lending market that we cover, the covered bond market, which is has some similarities with what we're talking about here, secured lending based on mortgages, and of course the RMBS market.
Yeah, I think that's right. And what we've got at the moment, which is quite interesting, is a kind of real run of sterling issuance, because in the first part of this year, the ECB's ABS purchase program, which was where they bought securitizations in euros, was ending. So all the euro issuers were very keen to get out ahead of that, which meant January, February and March were very dominated by euro issuance. And then the market had a fairly tricky April because of the banking troubles. So only then did the sterling suppliers finally get to kind of have their moment. And since then, we've had a run of buy-to-let deals, which have really tightened. And now we're finally seeing prime deals. And this is the busiest week for prime supply for a year, but three prime deals in a week, which is what we've had this week, is a very exciting move for the securitization market.
Yeah, that's
quite much more to supply than you would really otherwise expect.
Yeah, and it's quite an interesting pricing dynamic, isn't it? Well, let's talk about the two of the most headline grabbing deals that came this week. They were from Lloyds, which revived its permanent shelf, which is something we talked about before on the podcast with your colleague Tom, who you wrote this story with, as well as our cover bond editor Bill Thornhill. Well, tell us a bit about that, the characteristics of that deal. I mean, how big was it, and what was the spread that the issuer paid? Because those are quite sort of notable features, aren't they?
Yeah, so permanent from Lloyds, originally slated at 500 million. But they managed to double the deal size to 1 billion. I think they were always intending to increase the size, which meant that they maybe priced it slightly wider than where they could have, because they still had a book of 1.6 billion, but ultimately it landed at 52 basis points over SONIA.
And Virgin Money, via its subsidiary Clydesdale Bank, did a £500 million deal, and that also priced at 52 basis points over SONIA. But what was significant about that spread versus the Lloyds deal?
Well, permanent, Lloyds Permanent is one of the biggest names in securitization, not just UK RMBS, but all of European securitization. And that means it's incredibly liquid. And so you would expect the Virgin deal to maybe price slightly outside that. And it has done historically. The fact that their pricing level, I think, would be considered a very good result for Virgin, although Permanent obviously was the one reopening the market with the first deal since February, and it was its return deal after 4 years away from the market, whereas Clydesdale Virgin have been in the market. I think this is their third deal since the start of 2021. So
right. And that spread of 52 basis points over SONIA is also significant for both deals generally, isn't it? Because like we mentioned earlier that the covered bond market is another avenue that banks fund themselves in, where they do secured lend or secured borrowing based on mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, basically. These two deals were unusual, weren't they? Because they, well, tell us why they were unusual in terms of pricing versus covered bonds.
Well, they landed well inside covered bonds, which you would think would be unexpected for RMBS, because many people would tell you covered bonds are the superior bit of paper. Mm. They offer dual recourse in both the collateral and the actual borrowers and the actual borrower, whereas securitizations only offer the collateral pool. But yeah, these two deals were inside where recent sterling covered bonds have been, and in particular the Lloyds deal was inside Lloyds's most recent covered bonds.
By how much? When did Lloyds last come to the market, and what did it pay for a covered bond?
So they came in November last year, and they were priced at 65 basis points. So
yeah,
this one was 52, so that's quite a way inside, although covered bonds have tightened a bit since then.
Right. And of course, we should also add that covered bonds tend to get better regulatory treatment, don't they? Which of course affects how many people can buy them, or how willing they are to buy them. Now, it was interesting as well, I thought, on the Lloyds permanent deal that it added 144A documentation, which means that certain US investors could buy it too. Did we think that had an effect on the pricing? And was there any sense that there was a bigger audience generally, not just in the US, for these deals? And that's what might have brought the pricing tighter?
Well, I think one of the things that was key to the pricing is that this was a very anticipated deal. Everyone was very excited about this. It's one of the darling names of securitization returning to the market. I think there's not been much supply this year. Lloyds is the fourth prime deal, UK prime deal of the year. So there was plenty of cash built up. I mean, speaking to people before the deal came, the one investor told me that people are as keen as they could ever be for permanent. As to the 144A, I think that's something that people are certainly considering in securitization. If they have to start using it as a more reliable source of funding, you can't be dependent on one currency and you can't be dependent on one collateral type, because at the moment the securitization market is subject to a lot of volatility. It can so easily become oversupplied. So if you don't have options for where you can go in those periods, then you really can't depend on securitization, or you have to be very willing to accept that your funding is going to be expensive. On this particular deal, I don't think that made a lot of difference, because the investor base was still very heavily from the UK. But I think it's something that Lloyds are definitely kind of preparing for future deals. There used to be a lot more US dollar UK prime RMBS. That market hasn't quite reopened in the way it did before the pandemic and the central bank funding schemes opened. So that's definitely something to look for in the next few months and years of the UK RMBS market.
So how are we left then after this week? Do you think that, you know, there are going to be other deals in the pipeline because of the sort of wider dynamic we talked about at the start about central bank funding and so on, or the lack of it. Is this the era in which RMBS permanently prices inside of covered bonds, or do you think that will be maintained, or and how are people feeling about the rest of the pipeline and the deals to come? Because this product does not have the same sort of size audience, does it, as covered bonds or other types of bank bond issuance?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. I think to maybe understand a bit of the dynamic here, it's a good idea to look at what's happened in UK buy to let this year, which is that people started the month, I guess, very kind of excited about the prospect of like supply. They were saying we've been really undersupplied, and they started the year at 150 basis points. The first deal of the year in January was 150 basis points over SONIA, and it tightened all the way to 110, and now it's gone back out to 115. And in all that time, like, there hasn't been a massive amount of people saying the macro circumstances have really changed. It's been a dynamic driven by kind of mostly how much supply there's been and how keen people are to hold sterling paper. So I think that what that tells you is you've got a very slim investor base who will invest when they see the opportunity, when they have cash, because they see securitization as a great deal. But the investor base doesn't expand much. So anyone who is a securitization investor will want permanent. It's a liquid name. And that means it can achieve a very tight spread. But I don't think it's necessarily sustainable. I mean, there's other people who've expressed the same view, and there's other people who've said maybe it's covered bonds that are too wide at the moment. But I see it mostly as an artifact of just how slim the investor base in RMBS is. That said, it's an extremely like positive and exciting moment for the market, and people are rightly excited.
But I wonder if that investor base is ever going to grow if the product doesn't overcome its sort of, I suppose, structural shortcomings versus covered bonds, say.
Yeah, I did ask someone that exact question, and he looked at me and smiled and said, that's a bit chicken and egg, isn't it? But I think it's a kind of gradual process, an iterative process. Like when people see a big name like Lloyds, they think maybe we want to come into this market, maybe we want to come into this space. I mean, and then if there's regulatory changes and other things that kind of make the case for securitization, the liquidity gets better, then more investors can come in. I think that there is a problem, which is you can't sort of dip your toes in securitization. Like once you become a securitization investor, you've got the capabilities to do that. You've got the staffing to do that, then you'll want to stay around. And so there needs to be a pretty sustained promise that the market can deliver before this expansion of investors really happens on the scale that would be needed.
To follow all the capital markets covered in this episode, from US Treasuries to European securitization, right down to Latin American high yield, head to globalcapital.com for more. It only remains for me to thank John and George for recording this episode with me, and to thank Gerald Hayes, our producer, who edits it together. Thank you, of course, for listening. We'll be back with more from the capital markets next week. Thank you and goodbye.